So we're going to begin with the very, very beginning of the Torah. And the way I'd like to approach this is as follows. I'm just going to, please do unmute yourselves and answer this question. I'm going to imagine that most of us have some familiarity with the beginning of the Torah. Right? We know that the beginning of the Torah, in a very, very basic way, really without getting into too many specifics, describes in how, in some way, which is very hard to understand, how God created the basic elements of this of the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. That's what the beginning of the Torah is about. And I'll share my source sheet in a minute, but that's what it's about. We know this. Now, I have a picture book in the back, where you have a sort of a picture that kids learn in school already. On the first day, God created the light and the darkness. On the second day, he created the sky, and so on and so forth. We know the story. I think there are two big questions that relate to the Genesis story. Two big types of questions. And I'd like to address both in a general way tonight, but I'd like to start with the second, okay? But tell me, before I get to my two big questions with Bereshit, with the beginning of the Torah, the very beginning, the first chapter, I'd like to hear from you. When you think about the first chapter in the Torah, what questions do you have? What bothers you about it? About this brief description of how God created the world in 6 days. I'll unmute. Please unmute yourselves as you'd like. Well, what questions arise when you look at it? Says God created the world, the heaven and the earth, and he created it one, you know, on the second day, the sky, and it talks about how he created the ocean and separated it from the land. What bothers you about all of this? Yes, Paul.
The world is singular.
The world is singular, meaning?
One world?
One world. What about the other worlds? What about all the? What about the universe? What about Mars? You know, what about Pluto? You know, there's so many. Is that what you mean?
That's exactly what I mean. That's
hey, beautiful. We're actually gonna talk about that. And any other questions that anyone has about the first part of Bereshit? Paul's got another one. Go for it.
It seems to be in conflict with science.
Okay, beautiful. It's in conflict with modern cosmological theories. And you don't need to be a scientist to know this, right? This is worth pointing out. You don't need to have 21st century knowledge to know that it's hard to understand how grass and vegetation can grow without a sun, right? Like they probably, when the Torah was written, they probably knew that. You don't have to be a scientist to know that it's hard to understand what light there could have been, again, without the sun and moon, or how to count days without the sun and moon, right? So, and beyond that, you know, today, we have unique scientific challenges, such as challenges in terms of the age of the universe, how could all of that have happened in 6 days, challenge in terms of the, you know, evolution and how we came to be here, and it doesn't seem that there was specific creation. So that's another big challenge. It doesn't reason with science. And any other questions?
Yeah, why did he bother making it?
Why did he bother making the earth? Okay, that is a hard question to answer. That's a good one. I don't think that's Bereshit's fault, though. But I think that's a good question. You know, it doesn't answer that. Okay, you could have had Kaku said, "Here's why I made the world," and you didn't. That's a fair question. Okay. Anything else, Elliot? Do you wanna say something? I don't hear you. Doc, can you raise your volume or okay. You're still muted?
I think I'm now unmuted.
You're good.
The tree of knowledge. I don't know.
Question mark.
Why did he put it there? Like, was he setting them up? Like, was he setting Adam up, you know, by putting it there? There was some type of a conspiracy here, having that tree there.
Right.
Why did he do that?
Right, so Adam and Eve,
why did he do that?
Many questions about the story of Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, that we can ask. I'm not even only directing the first few psukim, 100%. Anyone else that hasn't raised a question yet before I raise mine? Paul's got a lot of questions. I will take one more from Paul and one more from someone else, if anyone anyone else has any questions they want to raise before we... David is raising his hand.
It seems like mankind today has the ability to destroy the world. And we may be, in fact, on a path of destruction of the world.
Okay.
How does it jive with Bereshit?
Interesting. So that's sort of like a... Is that specific to Bereshit, or that's just a general question? Like, God created the world, but what if we destroy it?
On your source sheet, you referred to certain abilities of mankind and what man can do, whatever. And one of the things that man can do now, it seems to me, is we're on a pretty good path to destroy our own world. Well, if God created the world, how can we destroy it?
Okay, that's a good philosophical question I want to think about. I don't want to answer that right now, but I want to stick to. So I want to mention one more question, and then I want to, then I'll share the source sheet with you. And that is as follows, okay? So I think there are a lot of difficulties with the text. I have a bigger question, which is, what is the point of it? Why do we need to know it, right? Now, what I mean by that isn't, so it's important to know that God created the world. That's really important, right? That there is a creator, that there is a being that controls the world, that's involved with the world, and all that's really important. My question is, you know, we learn on a very elementary, shallow level that certain things were created on the first day and the second day and so on. Who cares what day each thing was created? Why in the world does that make a difference? How does that affect my religious life? How does it help me to know that God created the Adam and Eve in the sixth day, which is the same day he created the animals? No, what does that tell me? It doesn't tell me, like, the Torah doesn't tell me how he created it. Like, if it was a scientific word, and that's, I think, a corollary, is this meant to be a scientific work in that is God trying to teach us how he created the world? Is he trying to teach, like, this is how things came to be? Because if so, you know, maybe this is blasphemous, but I don't think he did a great job in the sense that it's really, so God said something and it happened, right? That's what we read. Okay, well, how did it happen? Poof, you know, magic trick, they kind of puffed into thin air. That doesn't, like, how did it happen? It doesn't do that very well. If the point is to teach me how the world came to be and how everything came to be, it doesn't seem like it did its job. So then what is the point of saying this? So that's the question I want to address, and I hope that I can also get back in a general way to some of the other questions. So with that, I'm going to share my source sheet, and we'll begin. Okay. And please unmute yourselves if you do have any points. So the truth is, as I think you will see, that I'm not the only one that had this question. This bothered almost all the Mefarshim. In fact, it's a Midrash. So we have here, in this little title, Why Begin from the Beginning? Read the first verse in the Torah. As I mentioned, I'm a bit scared to translate this pasuk because it's just so complex, just to how to translate what the following words mean. But we're going to have to do our best just for now. In fact, if you want, we could spend a whole entire shiur just translating the words of this first pasuk. But that's not what I want to focus on. So the Torah begins as follows. It says, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. Right? That in the beginning of time, when time was created, what you can even say, when time came into being, God created the heavens and the earth and all that that entails. That is the beginning of the Torah. So the first word of the Torah, the beginning of the Torah, starts in the beginning. Which I would have thought, you know, putting my first question aside, I would have thought that makes a lot of sense, right? Like, if you wanted to begin a book, in the beginning sounds like a pretty good word to begin with, right? It literally has beginning in it. Seems pretty fair, doesn't it? I would have thought so. But this Medrash that Rashi quotes here, Shlomi Yitzchaki, probably the most famous commentator on all of the Bible, quotes here, is bothered. Well, why begin from the beginning? Take a look at the source number two here, where Rashi says as follows, Bereshit, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak said, Lo ahaya tzarich lahachil et ha-Torah ela me'achoresh hazelachem. The Torah should have began from the verse in Exodus, which says, this month will be for you, describing the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. So the Torah should have began from there. She mitzvah rishona shenitzvah by Yisrael. Because that's the first commandment Jews were given. We should have began from the first commandment. That's what the Torah, that's what Rashi says here. It's strange. Why talk about the beginning of time? Why begin from the beginning? Umatam patap of Reshit. Why did the Torah begin with Bereshit, with Genesis? Mishom koach ma'asav higilamo. So now Rashi is going to give an answer. I don't even want to spend too much time on that answer, but I'll just read it. And maybe another time we can explore this answer. But I'm really more interested in the question. But the answer is as follows. Mishom koach ma'asav higilamo. Because of Pasuk in Tehillim, Pasuk in Psalms, which says that God told the power of his actions to his people. Latet lahem nachlat goyim, in order to give them the inheritance of nations. She'im yomru umot olam Yisrael, if the nations of the world say to Israel, listim atem, you're a bunch of robbers and thieves. And, you know, might sound familiar, might we still hear, you're a bunch of robbers and thieves taking Israel, right? If they say that, because you conquered the land. How dare you, Jewish people, conquer the land of Israel? You're a bunch of thieves. So, hey, Omer Lehem, the Jews can say, the whole land is God. It's God's land. He created it and gave it to he who was straight in his eyes. He gave it to the nation that was upright. So, no, not Lehem. God gave it to the nations of the world in his will. He desired to do that. He had a ratzon. He had a will to do that. And God also had a will to take it away from them and give it to us. So on a simple level, Rashi is saying, why begin with Bereshit? In order to so that the Jews have a response to other nations as to why we have a claim to the land of Israel. Now, I don't want to focus on the answer, but just for a minute, does that answer satisfy the question, in your opinion? Okay, Rashi's question was, why don't we begin with the first mitzvah? The answer, to teach the Jew, other people, other nations, so that we can say, look, God made the world. Look, it says in the Torah, God made the world. That's the first pasuk in Bereshit. He gave it to us. Is that a satisfying answer?
Not really.
I agree. I don't think it's satisfying at first glance at all. For a number of reasons. Number one, you know, it doesn't really explain a lot of Bereshit, right? It could just say God created the world, and that would have been suffice on a simple level, right? Number two, do the nations care what it says in the Torah, right? Like, I don't know. I don't think if Prime Minister Netanyahu, right, went to anyone from the PA and said, look, guys, I'm going to solve this problem right now. It's a pasuk in the Torah. Right? I don't think he'd be, oh, you know what? You're right. You're right. You guys take Israel. We're going to go to, I don't know, Egypt now. I don't think it's going to happen. Right? So what is it really? What do we accomplish? So there's a lot to say about the answer, but I want to focus on the question. Is it really true that the Torah should have started from the first commandment? Why do we really think that everything until then, which means the stories about the creation of the world, and Adam and Chava, and Noah, and Abraham, and Sarah, and all that stuff, was it necessary? Does that make sense, really? Like, you know, every day we pray to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Like what? So God should have just left Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob out of there? In addition to the fact that many of the mitzvot we do have rely on things that happen before that first mitzvah, right? Like, what about the mitzvah of Brit Milah that God gave to Avraham? How would that make any sense without the stories? The mitzvah of Gidhan Asher, right? Where Yaakov was fighting with the angel in the Torah story, and then he got wounded. Well, how would we have known about that? So it's not, Robert, it's all very satisfying. Yes, Paul.
Why don't you just have a book with 613 pages?
That's what it's suggesting, right? 613 pages of commandments. That's what the question is suggesting.
Finished.
Sorry, what did you say?
I said, shine. It's finished. The book was 613 pages.
Good. So Paul's making you, so Paul's explaining this question in one way. There are two ways to explain it. I think there are two ways to explain it. Paul says, well, look, what is the Torah? It is an instruction manual. That's what it's there to do. The Torah is not there to teach us history or to teach us, cosmology or science. That's not, we have other books that do that more directly, right? We have history books, we have science textbooks. The Torah is there to tell me how to live, tell me what to do and what not to do. And so therefore the question is, just tell me what to do, what not to do. That's the basis of the question. Maybe you could have thrown in like a little anecdote, you know? So it says we eat matzah on Passover. Oh, why? Well, there was a story that happened, you know, that with the Jews and they were leaving and they didn't have time to do it arise. That could have been a parenthetical, but the main thing is eat matzah. The main thing is don't steal, don't kill. That right? So that's one way to answer the question. I think it's a good answer. I'm personally not satisfied with it for the following reason. I think if the Torah was simply a book of just do's and don'ts, it would lose so much of its richness. It would be so dry. And I think that most of us would argue that the stories in the Torah aren't just stories, and as we'll see, reflected in some of these sources later, aren't just stories, but they actually, you know, give us fundamental lessons in terms of how to go about our daily lives. There's more to telling someone how to live than just saying, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. You just tell that to people, you know, that doesn't really resonate. There's another way to explain this question, and that is what the Ramban gets to in source number 3. And what the Ramban basically says is as follows. He says, look, I understand that there's important stuff in Bereishit. The problem is we don't get that stuff from looking at it because it's incredibly difficult to understand what any of this stuff even means. And you could read Bereishit and still not know much after reading it. And you have way more questions than answers. So given that the Torah, for whatever reason, wasn't going to give us many details, so why bother? Meaning the question isn't that, oh, the Torah, those stories aren't important. Only commandments are important. But the question is if you're going to tell me about the creation of the world and Adam and Eve and the tree of knowledge, as Elliot mentioned before, and all this stuff, well, at least tell it to me in a way that I can understand. Simply saying that God waved his magic wand and poof, there's all this stuff, it doesn't really tell me much at all.
But Rabbi, the Torah is more than just a law book that we're just supposed to follow and follow the instructions as to what to do when the time comes. And without the questions that we were posing and have been posed, it opens up the venue to do more research, to dig, to read more and to find out. I mean, this is what it's all about. It's all about discussions and finding out what it really means when something is said.
Right. So I think Albert's suggesting that sometimes ambiguity is helpful because it sort of opens up the floor for discussion and questioning and analysis and back and forth. I 100% agree, which is why I don't think that just saying we should have been do's and don'ts would have been sufficient. But what the Ramban says is something different. He said, take a look here at source number 3 for a second. I'll read it inside here. A question you could ask on this midrash, because there's a big reason that the Torah should have began from Bereishit Bara Elokim. Right? It makes perfect sense to do that. Yushoresh HaEmunah, it is the root of our faith. If a person thinks that the world always existed, that there was no creator, who kofer be'ikr ve'ein lo Torah kral, such a person is denying a fundamental of our faith, and they have no Torah to live, no Torah rest on. If there is no creator, there can't be a Torah. So of course you need to know Bereishit Bara Elokim. So what's this question? And the Ramban says, v'atshuva m'nei shemase bereishit sod amuk eino milveh min ha'mikra. Because the act of Genesis, this creation story, is a deep secret. You cannot understand it simply from reading scripture. Lo yivada al bor yo ela mi piha kabbalah and Moshe Rabbeinu piha gura. The only way to understand it is through a tradition that we receive from Moshe that he passes down from one generation to another. V'odav chayavim lahastir oto. And those who know it have to conceal it. L'kach amar Rebbe Yitzchak she'en l'hachalat ha-Torah tzorev reshe bara. That's why Rebbe Yitzchak says we didn't need to begin with creation. We didn't need to know what was created the first day, what was created the second day. That's all unnecessary. Certainly we don't need to know about the flood or the story of the tower of Babel and the dispersion. Because we don't get that much from them. And those who know the tradition don't need these verses for them to hold their tradition. All we needed to do, God could have just said, look, Aser Adibro, what's the first commandment? I am the Lord your God. I created the entire world and everything in it. Now, obey me. We don't need all the specifics, the trees and all that stuff, which aren't specifics. They're so general. So why do we even have them? That's the question. That's the purpose. That's what's really behind it. Of course we didn't know God created the world. Of course we didn't know about the root of our faith. But the question is, what about all these specifics? So I think what you see here's the point I want to make, okay? Going back to sort of our first two type of questions, right? We have two types of questions. One is, how do we reconcile Bereshit with modern science, with what we know about cosmology, even with ancient science? How does any of this make sense? And question two is, what's the purpose of teaching us the 6-7 days of creation, of telling that story? And what I think you see is that the Ramban, who didn't know anything about evolution or the age of the universe as we know today, right, before any of that stuff was an issue, the Ramban's already telling us that you can't take the Psukim of Bereshit at surface value. That there's much more beneath the surface. That's simply reading and translating, which is hard in and of itself. Again, it's hard to just translate the words. Even if you can, and you read and translate the words of Bereshit, you're not getting at the depth. You're not really getting the point, and you're not meant to. The Torah was specifically written in a secretive way, and that's on purpose. And the question is why? That's going to be the question. Why is it so secret? Right? Why can't the Torah tell us? You could ask if God did know, right? God knows the science. So if indeed God knew that the world was millions and millions of years old, why didn't he make that more clear? Right? That's a similar kind of question. Why is it so secret? And that's what I want to sort of address next. The secret of creation, why, but what I think you do see is if it is a secret, right? If it is a secret, it means that there is much more than simply knowing what God created on which day. It has to be more than that, because that's not too secretive, right? Our little children can memorize a chart which says that God created the animals in the sixth day and the fish and the birds in the fifth day. They get that. That's not the secret. So what is it getting at? What are these secrets? And I'm not going to reveal the secret. Like, I don't know the exact secrets, but what are the general messages and lessons the Torah is conveying to us through telling us this information? Okay? Any questions before I go on? Thoughts, concerns? Okay, so we move now to the second part of the discussion where we see again that it's not just the Ramban, but already 2,000 years ago in the times of the Mishnah, right, end of the Second Temple period, in the times of the Talmud, already at that point in history, Chazal were telling us, the sages, the rabbis were saying that the beginning of the Torah is a secret. Right? It's not something that you should treat lightly. Not something that you should just read the Pesukim and say, okay, that's all that means to say, that, God said, let there be light, and there was light. There's more to it. Take a look at source number 4. So it says as follows, Ein dorshin ba'arayot b'shlosha. We don't teach or expound upon forbidden relations in the presence of three. Meaning if you had three people, that's too many. Now, this isn't the topic of our discussion. What we mean here is, what the Gemara refers to is there are certain, I guess, leniencies in terms of, let's say, what's a biblical prohibition, what's not a biblical prohibition, in terms of people one can have relations with and one cannot. And if we would publicize this information to a great extent, people might misunderstand them, misconstrue them, and commit certain violations, and therefore we don't publicize them. Again, not public our discussion, but that's what that means. But here's the main thing. Below b'masa b'resha b'shtayim. You can't teach the creation story, ma'asa b'resha, or the secrets of creation, as we'll see, to more than one person at a time. You can't, even two people is too many. It's that secret. Below b'merchava b'yachid, and you can't teach about God's divine chariot as described in Yechezkel and Yeshaya, you can't teach about that only to one person, even to one person, unless that person is wise enough to understand by themselves, which means, as again, not necessarily the topic of our discussion, but in terms of the secrets of really mysticism, of, you know, God and the upper realm and his relationship to angels, and that image of God and his holy chariot described in Nevi'im, you can't even teach that at all unless you can give over hints and generalities, and if people can pick it up by themselves, then you can teach it. And then the Mishnah continues. Kol mistarka mistakel ba'arbad varim rasoi shalo kiu lo kiu balo balo olam. It would be better not to be born if you look at the following four things. That's obviously a euphemism, right? What doesn't mean that if you ask these questions, you know, then off with your head. It's to discourage people, as the Rambam is going to tell us, from thinking about these four things. What are they? Mala mala, mala mata, mala fanim, mala achor. What is above, what is below, what is before, and what is after. And what we mean by that is questions like, and there are different opinions, what happened before there was anything? What happened before God, quote unquote? We don't believe in that, but like, what could have happened? You know, what's above everything? What's below everything? In terms of, you know, distance and place, or any limits, time and space. These are the types of questions the Mishnah is telling us not to think about. Okay. Similarly, we have this explicitly in source number 5, which relates to our psukim directly. The Midrash Rabbah says as follows: "Vayar Elokim mikol asher asa." So God saw all that he had made. Rabbi Levi Patach, right? That's the last pasuk, right? Right before we get to Shabbat, the last pasuk in the 6 days is God saw everything that he made, and it was really good, right? Just, you know, another question, right? What in the world does that mean, right? Like, you can imagine God's, like, looking at his creation. He's like, yup, that is good. That I did a good job. That isn't mediocre. No, this is a good world, right? Like, again, it begs the question, what in the world is that even saying? But that's the last pasuk, that's the last verse describing the 6 days of creation. And that's what Rabbi Levi says as follows. Levi Patak, Kivod Elokim Haster Davar, Ukvod Melachim Chakor Davar. The glory of God should be concealed. When it comes to the glory of God, you should conceal the matter. Kivod Melachim Chakor Davar. But when it comes to the honor, the glory of kings, then you can reveal the matter. What does that mean? Rabbi Levi Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina Amar, right? Rabbi Levi says, from the beginning of the book until this last pasuk, until we get to the pasuk about Shabbat, that's God's glory. Conceal it. Don't publicize it. Don't spend too much time. Don't publicize the secrets of the 6 days of Bereshit. Don't do that. Mikan ve'ela kivor malachim chakor davar. And then once you get past the first 6 days, then you could start analyzing, asking questions, you know, questioning, why does this make sense? I don't understand this. Explain it to me. That's once you get past the first 6 days. But the first 6 days, conceal it. That's what it says. were meant to conceal it. And again, this is 2,000 years ago, before they had questions exactly, you know, between the modern science and the creation story. They were already told, this is a secret. Now, I want to make 2 points before I question why. What is so bad about all this stuff? Why is it a secret? And I'd like to hear what you think about that, but I want to make 2 points. Point number one is that, again, clearly there's more here than just the surface. But point number two is that we have to have a certain measure of humility when considering these psukim. That's what Chazal are telling us. Don't think that you completely get it, because there's a lot here, and this is fundamental stuff. And if you're going to say something definitively, you better know what you mean. And in fact, even if you do know what you mean, maybe better not to share it at all. And before exploring this, I want to reiterate that I don't claim to be giving all the answers to all the questions here. There's an infinite amount of information and depth to these psukim. But I do think that we can try to gain from them in our level, because on the end of the day, it's our Torah. And I think that people have questions, right? And to just leave those questions is not a good way forward. So why are these things a secret, right? That's the question. What do you think? Why are we so secretive about these things? Why is it that we can't talk about Bereshit? Simple understanding. Why are we so secretive? Any thoughts? What's dangerous about teaching Bereshit?
It could lead to a lot of criticism as to why. Obviously, now we can ask the question: is if it was so good, why is it so bad?
Okay, not so good after all. You're saying,
you know what I mean? Like,
okay, good.
It doesn't seem like it's such a perfect world.
Good.
So people will start criticizing and asking questions, and it would lead to non-belief of Hashem.
So that I agree with that, but I want to take it a step further, though. Meaning, you're saying, well, people are going to ask questions about it. But okay, like, if the questions are fair questions and they're there, we usually don't discourage questions.
No, but the where are the answers? Oh, that's the question.
Okay, good.
Who is knowledgeable enough?
Well, if you have
to know why God did a certain thing at a certain time.
Right. Oh, people are freezing.
I mean, the rabbis can write all they want about certain things.
Right. Okay. So that's a fair. You're saying. Well, maybe you won't give him a good answer. But if you know the answers, let's say you are a incredibly bright person with, you have a tradition, you know, mysticism. Let's say you have the answers. So why can't you tell them? What do you think, Elliot?
I think ultimately nobody really has the answers.
Okay.
No human has the answers.
You don't have the answers.
Even a learned person, you know, who studied for, you know, for years and spends all their time studying and learning, ultimately, we don't know. You know, only Hashem knows the answers.
100%. Okay, great. So maybe we can never have confidence that we know the answers. Maybe that's the point, because there's such fundamental questions. All good points. Did anyone else want to give a suggestion why we have to keep the secret? So I think everything that everyone said has been right. I'm not going to read source 7, it's 4-6 rather. It's just the Rambam on this Mishnah. But what he basically says here, I want to read instead of source number 7. What he basically says here, and you can read it inside, is everything that people have been saying, which is that people can read the creation story and say, wait, that's not right. That's not what I learned in fifth grade. You know, that's not how it happened. You know, that's not how plants grow. Plants don't grow without sun. That's wrong. And if you teach it to them and they don't understand, then we have a big problem for two reasons. And what he actually says is as follows. People are going to want to learn this stuff. I think that it's part of the issue. People want to ask these questions. Everybody wants to know everything they can about the world. We live in it, right? Like, everyone's curious about where the world came from and where people came from. So people want to know these things, but they're complex and they're hard to understand. And I want to add, it's almost impossible to think of you know, a world before time, because we live in a world that exists as we know it. And thinking about creation is thinking about a world that existed in a completely different way. And so it's very hard to relate to. It's really not easy to think about what the world would have been before time. Like what does that even mean before time? Yes, Paul.
But you're applying your standards today and your understanding today of something that happened then.
Right, right.
So our level of understanding today is based on the science which we know today.
Right.
And you're trying to transpose that back to start of civilization according to the Torah.
Okay, so I want to make 2 points to that. Number one, point number one is that I'm pointing out that already 2,000 years ago, they thought this stuff is really complex. So that's number one. Number two, I want to get to your point, though. And I think you are asking a good question, which is, what do we do with the fact that, look, and I'm going to be honest about this. If you look in the Rishonim, the medieval commentators on Bereshit, they try to explain the Pesukim based on their science. They do. They believe in elemental theory. They believe the world was composed of four primary elements, you know, air, earth, fire, and water. And they read that into Bereshit. Now, I think there may be ways of explaining that on a more, on a non-scientific level, but we don't hold to the elemental theory. We have a periodic table, right? We think there are way more than four elements. And Rishonim, but they always, people always, or not people, rabbis, biblical commentators, try to explain Bereshit based on the science that they know. So it rubs us the wrong way when we read it nowadays and we try to change everything. And what does it say about Bereshit if we're explaining it so differently than they did? If it can sort of oscillate, you know, so quickly. I think that's also a good point, but I want to get to it. Because I have a source that I think does address that. But the other point I want to draw out from this is the Mor Nevuchim in verse number 7, where he says two things. And I'll read it outside because, and I think where I want to get to some of the more of the answers here and what we should try to glean from it. But he says two things. Number one, he says as follows, and it's one more point I haven't made explicitly yet, which is if this is supposed to be a secret, it means you can't take everything literally. That's what the Rambam says, that some of this is figurative. It's a metaphor. It's not meant to be understood in the literal sense. One example he gives is the Rakia. Now that, you know, and if we can go into that if you want, it's a big question. What is the Rakia, the firmament, created in the second day? What in the world is that? Already the Rambam knew that there was nothing solid separating, you know, us from what we call the sky. And the Rakia certainly sounds like something solid. So the Rambam says, well, it's not literal. And that's the point. Not a lot of this isn't meant to be taken literally. Now, there is a big variety among the Rishonim and rabbis in terms of how figurative we're talking. And, you know, six literal days or six eons or, you know, eras. And, you know, that's a discussion. And not everyone agrees that you can just say it's six long eras. Maybe it was, and they think it was six 24-hour days. And we can talk about that too. But I think everyone will agree that we can't just read the words literally and think that's all they mean. There definitely is some symbolism here. And that's part of the issue, because when you get to symbolism, not everyone really gets it. Some people hear symbolism and they say, oh, yeah, sure. You know? So that's part of the point. But the next thing he says, though, is, because he does try to give a stab at it, we're not going to go through the whole thing today, is even though it's true that a lot of these things are secrets, it doesn't mean we can be silent. I'll just read the second, in English, the second paragraph here in the bold, if you look at source 7. We have thus clearly stated our opinion. It is, however, part of the divine plan that everyone who has obtained some perfection transmit it to some other persons, as we will be shown in chapter 1 prophecy. It is therefore impossible for a scholar to possess knowledge of these problems, whether it be through his own researches or through his master teaching, without communicating part of that knowledge to others. It cannot be done in clear words, and must be done sparingly by way of hints. Essentially, the Rambam I'm saying, I just went through telling you this is all a secret, and you can't teach it to the public. So why am I writing about it? And his answer is that we can't simply contain knowledge completely and not share it, right? Because that's not right. And this is our Torah. I think we all want to feel some sort of ownership over it. And to just gloss over the first chapters of Bereishit without getting anything meaningful out of them is not acceptable to all of us, I think. And that's why, despite the fact that it is a secret and there's more beyond the surface, I think it is worth studying. Okay.
Well, it's interesting what you just said, Rabbi, because I'm thinking about the story of Noah. And one of the questions that arises is the comparison between Noah and Abraham. I think the answer is that Noah kept things to himself where Abraham shared it with the world.
Right. And, it's a similar
point.
And
this point is what you just finished saying.
Right. It's a similar point.
If you have knowledge, you have to share it.
Exactly. Okay. And I think that's actually worth just a general point I think Albert's making. It's a really important point, which is that, even not in a formal sheer or class setting, but I think all of us that have some knowledge to share, we should feel that a responsibility to share that knowledge with people who can use it if they're open to it. And I think sometimes people say, well, look, I don't like to, I'm not a rabbi or I'm not a teacher, I don't have a degree, like who am I to share with other people? But that doesn't seem to be an appropriate, viewpoint, and that certain false humility can be destructive. If you have something that can help someone, you have knowledge to share, we should try to share it with people who are receptive. It doesn't mean you shove things down people's throats, but if people are open, then why not share your knowledge? You should. Okay. So now I want to end, or at least I don't know how we'll finish all of this now, but I want to get to some of the answers, right? If, as I'm arguing, we're not simply meant to look at the psukim at first surface value and understand all the science and all that behind it, then what is it here for? So I want to note the following, and this first source is going to get to Paul's point. All the sources we're about to read from the 19th century, right? So we started with Chazal, the sages, medieval commentators. The next three sources are from the 19th century, and I think that's significant because, actually, does anyone want to guess why that's significant? And we have the biblical scholars and rabbis in the 19th century now commenting on Bereishit. Well, if you know about history in the 19th century, it was the beginning of Haskalah, or when the Enlightenment really began, exactly, to spread throughout Europe. It was also, part of the beginning of the Reform movement. And it definitely, and I don't know about the beginning, but it's also when biblical criticism really started to flourish. So these rabbis are in the heat of it. Because on the one hand, they don't want to reject science or any of the new discoveries that scientists had discovered during their time, but they're faithful to the Torah and they're faithful to Bereishit. And so they're faced with this crisis, what do we do? And I think they all have different points to emphasize. But the main point to emphasize are that Bereishit, the beginning of the Torah, is meant to send an incredibly crucial theological message. That's the point of it. The point isn't the science. It's essentially, to summarize it, it's God's involvement in the world and specifically mankind. That's the main message of it. So let's begin with Rav Tzvi Hoffman. I want to point out that here, he actually, I think in a very beautiful way, addresses Paul's question, which is, what do we do with the notion that the science keeps changing and consequently the explorations and explanations of Bereishit keep changing? Right? What do we do with the fact that hundreds of years ago they thought there really was some sort of solid ceiling in the sky and now we don't? Like, how do we reconcile that? That's difficult. So take a look at what Rabbi Tzvi Hoffman says. And I'll read it in English. although, you know, a translation is always a step removed, but I want to make it as clear as possible. Okay, it says as follows. Because the Torah wanted to describe the history of mankind and the history of the people of Israel, which was separated, meaning the nation of Israel, to delegate its spirit unto it, meaning that God separated Israel to delegate the spirit of the Torah, to infuse the nation of Israel with the spirit of the Torah. Therefore, the Torah begins with the creation of the world as the beginning of human history, but gives us only what is important to human history only. And therefore, it was necessary to see the earth as a center and attract the rest to its circle of observation only to the extent that it has an affinity for the earth. Therefore, the Torah is not devoted to the nature of other worlds, the sun, the moon, and stars, much less the world of angels and spirits. Do you see how he's addressing one of your questions from the beginning of this year, Paul? Essentially, the Rav David Tziofman is making the point, the Torah is an anthropocentric work. It is geared toward humans. It is geared towards humans and human life. It doesn't need to go into detail about the sun, the moon, the stars, and all the planets, because those don't concern us in a direct way, at least as we know it. And I guess you could ask, what if we go into space, you know, and inhabit it? That's an interesting question. It's one, you know, I think it's worth thinking about, but I think it's still understandable. On a basic level, we live in the earth. And I'll also say, I'll allude to the fact, therefore, the Torah describes the world as you see it from the earth. The Torah is describing the earth as one would see it if one is standing on the earth and looking up and seeing the sun, the moon, the stars, and the sky. That's how it's described, because the focus is on us. It's not on the world. It's on us. That's the focus. It sees the sun, the moon as luminaries, whose function is to illuminate the earth and be signs of festivals and days and years, right? This is another question. It says, and God made the sun to illuminate the world. Isn't there another function of the sun? Like, what about photosynthesis? What about the fact that we need heat? You know, and what about all that? No, it's focusing on the sun as what it does for us in our daily life. That's the focus. It sees the sun, the stars are mentioned only incidentally as companions to the moon, as appearing within a night, and whose appearance shows the beginning of the night. And the Torah further emphasizes that everything that God created is good. What does that mean? It's good. That is, that it has everything necessary for self-existence now and in the future. And after man was created, God sees that he is very good, that is not only capable of sustaining himself, but also worthy of advancing his destiny and the purpose of man. From this, we learn that all creatures have a dual purpose, a self-purpose on one hand, and on the other, to serve man. The intention of the affair of creation is to teach us this only. And it does not intend to teach us methods from the various methods of the natural sciences regarding the creation of the world, right? So for the first point is Rav Tziofman saying, it's not there to teach you science. It's not the point of it. But he's not done. That's not the point of it. It's there to teach you. So far what he said is a few things. Number one, that God created the world and that it is good. That the world, everything in the world has a purpose, and it accomplishes its purpose, and that it also, it's there in the service of man, for mankind, for humankind to accomplish our greater purpose. And we'll have to see how he gets that. How do you get those messages from the text? I want to get to some of that today. But that's the point, that everything in the world is there for a purpose. Now, to you and I, maybe that seems pretty logical, but it's not necessarily so. Think about it. You walk out in the world, there's so much, it's so vast, it's so big, there are so many valleys and forests and water and everything. And you could say, well, what is this all here for? It seems sort of just random. It's all a bunch of stuff that's out there, you know, and maybe it just kind of happened. And further, you could say, and there's so many different things, there's so much variance. Maybe it comes from different sources, as we'll get to later. And the Torah says, no, it's all there for a reason, a unified purpose. Not just many purposes, but one greater unified purpose coming from one source of creation. I also actually found it fascinating, and we ask you in the second paragraph, if the Torah is the source of the purest recognition of the beginning of the Earth and its history, and all the assumptions of natural sciences cannot shed light on the beginning of the world to the same extent that the first episode of the book of Genesis does. What he means is you won't understand necessarily science from the Torah because it's not designed to teach you science. But at the same time, if you did completely understand those secrets, you would be able to get at the science. It's just that not everyone, and most people rather, will not understand the full depths of it. It's not a scientific work in the sense that it doesn't teach you science. That's not its point. But if you knew everything, you could learn science from it, which is interesting. We'll note the next source, Rav Shadal, from Shmuel David Lutzado, disagrees. He sounds like he's saying, don't even look to it for science at all. But he's saying you can learn from it. But I wanted to get to another point. He says as follows. The ancient time, meaning when the Torah was given, with its simplistic conception regarding the whole of creation, and the most modern time, with the advanced knowledge, both together can be found equally in the description of the Torah. The expressions of the Torah can easily be explained according to the various theories of the formation of the world. Only one rule is determined by the Torah, and indeed a very important rule, in a clear and unambiguous way, and that is that everything is formed in his will and exists only in his will. That's the unambiguous part. Everything exists because of God's will. And that Torah hints at that again and again. It's all contingent upon God's will. That's the point. That being said, any theory he's claiming of science can be fit into the word. And what he's saying is, it's specifically written in a general way because the Torah is an eternal work. And it needs to fit every generation's conception of science so that someone 3,000 years ago who's at Sinai with their limited understanding of science needs to be able to read the Torah, and it needs to be comprehensible. And it also needs to be comprehensible to someone who lives in 2020. It needs to be vast enough to span all history. Okay, we're running out of time. Yes, Paul.
How do you explain death and destruction and tragedy?
Death, destruction, and?
Tragedy.
Let me think about that one. I want to get to the next time, if you don't mind. Is that okay? I want to think about it. I don't want to give a shallow answer to it. I really appreciate the question. But I guess the short answer is I don't think Ki Tov means that. Tov doesn't mean it's good in the sense that we like it. Tov means it's good in the sense that it fulfills its purpose. Apparently, within the purpose of the world, there was room for destruction and darkness and all of that. That's part of the Ki Tov. For whatever reason, and God gives us free will, and he gives people the opportunity to make bad decisions, and he gives us challenges, but that's part of the purpose. So let me actually, I think the one, I want to get to source number 10, and maybe at least keep some of the questions.
The Holocaust was part of the service of the good?
The good in the sense, again, I'm not claiming to give an explanation of it, and it doesn't sit well with us, but it's part of God's vision of the world. I gave a different shiur, if you remember, like a few months ago about how you reconcile with that. The Baal Shem Rebbe says, you can't say such a thing. It's just God wanted to do it, and that's it. You don't reason about the Holocaust. I totally hear that. But I think to say tragedy in general, when we say good, it doesn't mean we like it, we're happy, we're celebrating and dancing. Yay, everything in the universe is awesome. I love it. It's tasty. It's yummy. You mean that it's good in the sense that it fulfills its purpose. That's what you mean. But it really relates to a lot of the questions, that sort of this disparity between the fact that God gives us freedom of choice, but he also created things, and how do you reconcile that with God having a vision for the world if we had the choice to ruin it? Those are all really important questions, but I just don't think I can get to them right now. But I do want to relate to Rav Hirsch, okay? If you look in source number 9, Shadal basically says as follows. I'll summarize it very briefly. He says, don't try to get science in the Torah. It's not a science textbook. You shouldn't try. It speaks to people as they are. It needs to be, what we say in Hebrew, shavel v'chol nefesh, for everybody, whether you're young or older, strong, weak, wise or less wise, the Torah needs to speak to you. And he says nature is that way also. People comprehend things based on where they are in life. A kid or a child experiences, something unfortunate in their life much differently than an adult does. nature is sort of fashioned us in that way, that our minds function at different ways at different stages of our life. The Torah is the same way, and it needs to be the same way because it's for everyone. That's why it's so general. But the point is to inform human beings, even the world here, of the unity of the world and the unity of human race. That's the point. The world is a one world. It's one world from one God. And finally, I'll just read from Rav Hirsch, and I want to get to some of the questions, and we'll have to close. Rav Hirsch argues as follows. In this first pasuk, what he says is, and I don't think we're going to be able to read it in time, unfortunately. Please look it on your own. What Rav Hirsch says is as follows. The first pasuk of the Torah is there to teach you three important things. Number one, God had free will. God has ultimate omnipotence and is all-powerful and can do whatever he wants. And the world didn't precede him. He had the power to shape it however he wanted. Therefore, if God is all-powerful and he could have made the world however he wanted, it means the world he created was the perfect world, notwithstanding all its faults, including all the things that we perceive as problems. If God could have done whatever he wanted to, and he made this world, this Tov Me'od world, it means it is the only possible world for fulfilling its purpose, because that's how God made it. And if he made man, and I know it doesn't sit easy with all of us, if he made man, that means that man has free will to accomplish our purpose, and it means that we were fashioned in the perfect way in order to accomplish that purpose. So I want to leave you just with the following questions. We'll get back to this next time, and then we'll summarize all that, because I don't want to go over time. If you look here, I have sort of the first 3 days of creation. And here's my closing question. Why is it so long and verbose? I have it here in colors for you. There's so many things that happen these first days of creation. God talks, right? God said, let there be light. Then he sees the light as good. Then he separates it. Then he calls the light day and the light and the darkness night. Can I summarize this for you, God? Let's just say this. On the first day, God created day and night. What am I missing? On the second day, God separated the higher water from the lower water. On the third day, God separated the water from the land. But no, God talks. He sees things are good. He separates between them. And he says, okay, let it be this way, and then it is that way. Why do we need all of that? What is the purpose of all of that? And so next time, I'd like to sort of explore those questions and those phraseologies and relate them to these greater themes of purpose, of will, of unity in the world that we discuss now. Okay, so I hope that you enjoy it. I hope this was informative. If those of you who I haven't met directly yet, if you would please have just take a minute to put your email here in the chat. Email me directly at sbergman@torontotorah.com. It's on the source sheet. I can email it to you if you'd like. And I'd like to chart this path away to cater toward people's interests and what drives them. But I hope this was informative, and thank you very much for joining. And I hope to continue learning with you in the future.